We won't be taking any calls or emails for this next segment, but stick with us in hour two to join a conversation about opioid addiction and alternative approaches to pain management. We want to hear your stories from 9 to 10 here on the Jefferson Exchange. And now we turn to a series of reports by JPR's own Leah Moriarty. These originally aired in June of 2015. Like so many areas in the country, our region is experiencing what public health officials describe as an epidemic of addiction to heroin and prescription opioid pain relievers such as Vicodin and OxyContin. One symptom of this epidemic has been a sharp rise in deaths by overdose. In this series, JPR's Leah Moriarty looks at this problem through the eyes of people on the front lines. We begin with an overview before turning to doctors and then getting the perspective of someone coping with addiction.
The first thing I realized when I started reporting on the heroin epidemic in Southern Oregon is that pretty much everything I thought I knew about it was wrong. For one thing, unlike some places I've lived, I didn't see strung-out junkies hanging out on the street, so how much of a problem could it be? But Joshua Grainer, an addiction counselor in Ashland, told me most heroin addicts these days are not your stereotypical street junkie.
These are professionals. They could be in government, they could be in medicine, they could be in drug and alcohol treatments as professionals that are actually actively using heroin, and they're doing a really good job covering it up.
Grainer heads Colpia Counseling Services in Ashland. He says he can count on one hand the number of his clients who started out using heroin. So how do professional people come to be heroin addicts? Dr. Jim Shame says mostly it's their doctors who started them down the road to addiction.
We've created a couple of generations of people who have been dependent on opioids because their physicians and their nurse practitioners and their PAs believed that what they really needed were opiates for their pain.
Dr. Shames is the medical director for Jackson County Health and Human Services. He's leading the local effort to rebalance what he sees as a long-time overemphasis on prescribing opioid painkillers. Those synthetic drugs chemically resemble heroin, and they act on the brain in similar ways. And for many addicts, heroin proves cheaper and easier to get than prescription opioids. Daryl Inaba says doctors weren't alone in creating the addiction problem.
We're in a major growing opiate epidemic, and it's been initiated, I believe, almost by the pharmaceutical industry.
Inaba is director of clinical and behavioral health services at the Addiction Recovery Center, or ARC, in Medford. He holds a PhD in clinical pharmacy, and his book on how addiction affects the brain has become a widely used training text. He notes the pharmaceutical industry successfully lobbied federal regulators to increase the potency of their opioid pain relievers, using industry-funded studies to argue the higher doses would not lead to patients getting addicted. Those studies, he says, turned out to be wrong.
They've learned a long time ago, as major capitalistic industries learn, addiction is money. If you got something that's addictive, people do whatever they can to get it.
The pharmaceutical industry has denied any intent to profit from addiction. Another assumption about heroin addiction I had to unlearn was a sense that it wasn't that big a problem. But according to the Centers for Disease Control, from 2010 to 2012, the death rate from heroin overdose doubled in a 28-state study area that included Oregon and Washington. Since 2009, more Americans die each year from drug overdose than from car accidents or guns. In Southern Oregon's Rogue Valley, there are 250,000 prescriptions written each year for opioid pain relievers. That's more than one prescription for every man, woman, and child in the valley. Living as I do in leafy, upscale Ashland, I assumed heroin addiction was likely focused in grittier parts of the area, like West Medford. Again, I was wrong.
It was very easy to get heroin in Ashland.
Diana Cooper is a 27-year-old mother of four and a recovering heroin addict. She started taking prescription opioids after a painful bout with meningitis when she was 18. She says the slide from prescription drugs to street drugs is ironically aided by attempts to rein in over-prescription of opioid painkillers.
When your doctor says, you know, I'm not supposed to prescribe these anymore, and so this will be your last dose, you're going to panic. And you're going to find an illegal source. And once you've broken that barrier into illegal sources and illegal activity, there's really no cap on it.
So as access to prescription opioids tightens, addicts shift to cheaper, more available heroin. In the 1990s, Jim Shames was a family physician in private practice, and when patients came to him complaining of pain, like most other doctors, he'd often prescribe opioid painkillers such as OxyContin or Vicodin.
It made sense to everybody. It made sense to me. That's the way I was practicing in the 90s.
Shame says doctors were being pressured to provide more pain relief. Research papers, many funded by the pharmaceutical industry, contributed to a growing professional consensus that opioid painkillers were safe and should be used more liberally.
When your state medical board says, hey, docs, you really need to be more compassionate about treating pain. When you go to the hospital and they say, don't let people suffer with pain, otherwise we will look negatively upon your recertification. After a while, you've created an entire thought bubble that supports your point of view, and that's where we have been for a while.
Shames reached a turning point several years after he became medical director for Jackson County Health and Human Services. In 2006, he says, the county medical examiner brought to his attention a stunning fact.
Do you realize we have about one citizen a week dying from accidental overdoses in Jackson County? And I said, I cannot believe those numbers. I said, you're going to have to show that to me. And we sat down in his office, and we pulled file after file after file of people who died from prescription drug overdoses.
Confronted with this grim toll, Shames started looking for ways to, as he put it, turn off the spigot on the opioid drugs that had become so ubiquitous. He formed the Opioid Prescribers Group and invited doctors and other healthcare professionals to develop new ways of treating their patients' pain that don't risk turning them into addicts. He says the existing treatment model simply doesn't work.
You walk in, we close the door, we spend 15 minutes, you expect a pill, I expect to give you a pill, and out you go, everybody's happy. This requires something very different.
Shames' group has devised guidelines for appropriate use of opioids based on research that suggests for most chronic non-cancer pain, opioids are not the best treatment. The group has also developed alternatives to opioids that involve a range of practitioners, from physical therapists and mental health counselors to acupuncturists and yoga teachers. Shames says this is a new approach for most doctors. But, he says,
whatever the modality is, whether it's way out there in terms of what a physician's comfortable with or something that really resonates in terms of the therapy they're used to, it's got to be coordinated. And that's where I think the difference is.
Shames says many doctors are getting on board with the new approach. Others, not so much. But he says the numbers show the effort is making a difference.
The most hard data you can look at is who lives and who dies. We had 46 accidental overdose deaths in 2006, and we're now down into the low teens or single digits.
But it turns out there's a perverse consequence of this success.
The more successful we are at reducing the number of pills being prescribed, the more expensive they become on the black market, and the price of heroin's just going down.
The result? What Shames calls a huge upswing in overdose deaths from heroin. The irony is not lost on him.
We've been concentrating initially on the upstream, which is, as I said, turning the spigot down, but there's a lot of downstream public health measures that we need to take as well.
Among those measures, Shames says, is making effective treatment available to those who got addicted by following their doctor's orders. He says he still carries that sense of responsibility.
I feel bad about it. I feel like I, in a sense, kind of pushed opiates on a number of people that would have been much better off without them.
Daryl Inaba understands the push for what's known in the medical field as compassionate pain management, but he says he realized some years ago that the movement to provide patients with adequate pain relief had backfired.
My God, doctors are overprescribing these things. They're addicting people. They're creating junkies out of law-abiding, decent people who now have to find their opiates on the street.
Inaba says a contributing factor was the pharmaceutical industry's successful effort to persuade federal regulators to allow opioid drugs such as OxyContin and Vicodin to be made in doses many times stronger. For example, he says,
we have Vicodin now, hydrocodone, which is classically only 5 milligrams, and now it's 80 milligrams and 120, so there was a whole promotion that these can be safely used and not addicted.
It didn't turn out that way. During the 2000s, communities across the U.S. saw spiraling rates of addiction to prescription painkillers and of deaths from overdose of those drugs. Between 2000 and 2012, nearly 4,200 Oregonians died from overdoses. And while OD deaths peaked several years ago, the death rate in 2012 was still four times higher than at the beginning of the decade. Daryl Inaba says natural opiates, such as heroin and their synthetic opioid cousins, are so powerfully addictive because they mimic the body's own pain-killing and stress-fighting chemicals.
And when they do so, your brain mistakes that it has enough balance of those chemicals, and it turns off its own chemicals.
When that happens, Inaba says,
your brain becomes imbalanced in chemicals so that you need to keep taking the opiates just to function as a human being.
Over the past several years, efforts to dry up that flood of pills have led to fewer people dying from prescription drug overdoses. Most doctors aren't writing prescriptions as freely, and insurance companies are limiting how long they'll pay for them. But making it harder to obtain these legal opioids hasn't helped the patients who are already addicted, and they often turn to heroin, which can be easier to get and cheaper than prescription pain pills. And while overdose deaths from opioid painkillers have started to decline, heroin ODs continue to rise. Inaba says efforts to fight the opioid addiction epidemic haven't translated into enough support for treatment programs such as the ARC in Medford, where Inaba is director of clinical and behavioral health services.
At the Addictions Recovery Center, we had 3 or 4 months waiting list to get into residential treatment, and a lot of the men on that waiting list are suffering from horrendous opiate addiction. And that what that means is many are going to die before they get in. Many are going to get incarcerated before they get in. And many are just going to give up and continue to use.
Inaba says it's time to rethink a common social judgment that says addicts are weak-willed, losers who cause their own problems and don't deserve public help.
Society needs to realize that it's not a matter of choice for these people, that it's a matter of their biology.
He says creating more opportunities for addicts to get help is not only the compassionate thing to do, it makes economic sense, too.
It costs us, what, maybe $40,000, $50,000 a year to keep somebody in jail. We gave that person $5,000 worth of outpatient treatment. We get much better outcomes, and they fare much better in society, fares much better, and there's less criminal recidivism.
For Inaba, the bottom line is that addicts aren't some anonymous other whose suffering we can ignore.
They're your children. They're your spouse. They're your doctor. They're your minister. They're your judge. Addiction crosses all lines because of its biology, not because of what the choices are.
Diana Cooper says probably the scariest moment in her addiction was the night she was driving with her 4 kids along the Oregon coast, headed toward Gold Beach.
And I had a lot of cocaine, but I didn't have any heroin. And so I was nodding out while I was driving. I kept doing more cocaine, thinking that would keep me awake, and I just kept nodding out. And I woke up hitting the guardrail on the other side where the cliff is to the ocean.
Cooper says her 8-year-old daughter Ada still talks about the time mommy wrecked the green van. Cooper started taking prescription opioid painkillers after getting meningitis when she was 18. She had ongoing migraines and was kept on opioid drugs such as Vicodin and Percocet for the next 7 years.
After a while, I realized that I did not like to function without taking my medication.
Cooper says she eventually needed the pills just to feel normal.
And you don't even realize that that's what keeps you normal. You know, that's what keeps you functioning.
When she was pregnant with her 4th child, her doctors kept her on the painkillers, but on lower doses. So she supplemented her prescriptions with pills from the street. Her son was born prematurely with a low birth weight. But Cooper says her doctors didn't seem concerned. At the time, she wasn't either.
Now, I can't even look at his baby pictures when he was first born. He didn't look normal. He was very gray, he had dark eyes, you know, he was very skinny, and I could tell. Now I can tell.
Cooper's life spiraled downward. For a while, she was homeless. She, her husband, also an addict, and the kids lived for several months in their van in a Walmart parking lot. Then, shortly after her youngest was born, Cooper tried heroin. She liked it a lot.
Your heart is racing. You get a rush. You get a lot of endorphins. You feel invincible to the point where I can do everything I need to do. Nothing's going to hold me back. No little pain, no illness, no nothing.
From then on, heroin was her drug of choice. Soon, though, Diana's husband, Matt, had had enough. He insisted they both get treatment, and reluctantly, she agreed. Cooper and her family got into a residential treatment facility where they could all be together. She says at first, all she could think about was getting a fix. but she knew if she left, she'd lose custody of her children.
That really says something to the pull of addiction when you're considering, do I stay here and get clean, or do I leave them all here and I go use? You know, when you're even contemplating that, I love my kids, and I would die for my kids, but at the time I wouldn't give up heroin for my kids.
On her third day in treatment, Cooper met a recovering addict who told how her newborn baby had been taken from her for several days when she entered treatment.
And she said that the day that they gave her her baby back, the want to use immediately was lifted. And as soon as she said that, mine was lifted. I realized I didn't have to want to use.
Cooper and her husband have been clean for about 2 years now. Both are working, and she's going to school to study early childhood education. She wants to be a clinical social worker. She still struggles with her addiction, and she says it's her day-by-day discipline to keep her dealings honest and above board.
I have to keep myself in check about everything. I can't lie for people. I have to be totally upfront and honest about everything in my life. Or else, yes, I will go back out.
Cooper is grateful for the help and support she and her family have been given to get their lives back on track. She urges people to get educated about the addiction problem and get involved in solutions, because she says addiction isn't something that happens just to other people's families. Liam Moriarty, JPR News.
Those reports, of course, were filed last year, and sadly the story is still grim for much of Oregon. We are looking at a long-awaited report by the Democratic staff of the Senate Committee on Finance released just this week, showing that in 2014, 522 opioid-related deaths in the state of Oregon, a jump of 13% from the prior year. Meanwhile, most recent federal data shows that only 12 facilities offering medication-assisted treatment are available in the state to serve 4,300 or so people, which means that 89 to 90, so 9 out of 10 Oregonians with a drug dependence problem are not receiving treatment. These are the latest facts coming out of the Senate Committee on Finance, led by Oregon Senator Ron Wyden. We have got a lot more to discuss about the complex problems of opioid addiction and also compassionate pain management coming up in hour two. We've surveyed residents from across the region about their experiences with painkillers and with opioids, both legal and illegal. The vast majority of people obtaining these things through a prescription. We'll have some medical docs on the line to talk about that and your stories coming up on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Emily Curitan. Please stick with us. Let's get the news first.